War Room, Pandemic. Here's your host, Stephen K. Bannon.
That is heroism. I want to talk about more about heroism. I want to bring in Patrick K. O'Donnell. The last book you did, you're a combat historian. You've gone with groups in Fallujah. You've embedded during the Iraq and Afghan War. You've been incredible. Your books on World War II, Korea War, Give Me Tomorrow, just incredible, incredible. But you kind of pivoted a couple of years ago with Washington's Immortals. It is still, if you want to see the intensity of combat, and that's what Patrick O'Donnell's not really giving you a lot of. It's strategy, but it's not a lot of the politics. It's the politics of the battlefield. He gives you a bird's eye view of putting you in the moment with units, whether it's a small unit of Marines in Fallujah going door to door, or it's a small unit of soldiers of Marines in Korea, right, at the Chosin Reservoir, right? But you get the grunt's eye view of what combat is at that time. And you see that with all the highfalutin talk and all the treaties and all the grand strategy and everything like that, it all comes down to the tip of the spear on both sides. Right, of who stands into the breach, and it always comes down to the little guy, right? The little guy. We hang in there, and essentially, is he prepared to give up his life for an abstract idea, which is called freedom? Now, it has reality and practicality, and they can see it, and that's why it's both. If you read his books, it's the camaraderie and cohesive unit cohesion that of their friends and that now their buddies. But also their homes, right? And this is what they do. So Washington's Immortals, which is an absolute incredible book, you've now fouled it up. We only got 2 minutes. We go to break. But the Indispensables. What motivated you first in 2 minutes to write this?
Basically, I found the story of the Indispensables through Washington's Immortals. These are the guys that transported Washington's army across the Delaware and also across the East River. But it's way more than that. As you said, this is a boots-on-the-ground story of the Revolution from the men at the tip of the spear at all the inflection points of the Revolution. They were also the intellectual mainspring of the early Revolution, which is really quite fascinating.
What do you mean the intellectual mainspring of the early Revolution?
Some of the key members of this group, for instance, Elbridge Gerry, he takes the abstract concept of republicanism with a small r and really translates it into reality. And it also it's imbued in our values in the early Revolution and then later on in the Constitution and Bill of Rights. He's incredibly important, along with other members. These guys also finance the war. They're some of the wealthiest men of the war. And they bring in a very crucial resource, which is powder. There's a massive ammunition shortage in 1774-75. And they convert their trade routes with Spain and the Dutch East Indies into supply lines. And they bring in all the powder. And okay. Italy, Israel. But it's also the boots on the ground, yeah. The guys that are there.
We're going to take a short break. We're going to be back in a minute. So you're going to tie together how they're intellectuals, how they're also financiers, and they got the working end of a ore right here. The Indispensables, it's out today. Patrick K. O'Donnell, if you want combat history, this is it. Short commercial break. We're going to come back in the War Room with the revered combat historian Patrick K. O'Donnell in just a moment. Citizens, not subjects, says Mark Fincham out in Arizona. That's what we call Arizona, the Concord Bridge, that Coliseum. Although I might have to change that to Lexington Common, the green at Lexington Common, because Georgia's going to be the Concord Bridge. That's going to be number two. Talk about citizens, not subject, the Indispensable. So here's we broke this on our Christmas Day special because why? Every year at Christmas, Patrick K. O'Donnell comes in and we go through the American battles that have taken place on Christmas days and what certain, whether the Korean War in Vietnam, World War II at Bastogne, the whole thing. We always go and do a very special part. And this year, in fact, quite frankly, we took an hour on crossing the Delaware. So I just want to make sure people, and particularly our podcast and radio audience, can see this. This book's called The Indispensables. It's out today. It's kind of the sequel to or the follow-on from the Immortals, Washington Immortals, which was the vanguard of this great regiment that did so much to save the Revolution. The famous painting of crossing the Delaware Are these the Indispensables? Are these gentlemen that are kind of nameless to history? Is this – you've now brought these gentlemen to life?
I actually focused on the forward portion of the boat.
Okay.
And these are the Indispensables. That's Emanuel Lutz focused in on them, and you can see there's an African-American rower in there.
Yep.
And that's him. He's a member of the Marblehead Regiment along with the other men. And the reason why it's so important, Steve, is Washington had four crossings of the Delaware that on Christmas Day. Three of them failed, except for the Marbleheaders.
Well, because it was a howling, correct me if I'm wrong, it was a northeaster had poured in. I mean, this storm that they had to, first off, a night, people should understand, a forced crossing of a river at night on any military objective, whether it was at Metz in World War II, the Patton's group, a forced crossing of a river is nothing more dangerous, correct?
That is correct.
And this happened in the middle of a howling northeaster.
Exactly. And the river was swirling. It was extremely dangerous. There was ice in it. It took all of the skill of the Marbleheaders to get across that river because all of the other parties that tried to cross failed. And they changed the course of the revolution that day.
Tell us about the Marbleheaders. Who are they? Why are they called the Marbleheaders?
Marblehead's located about 30 miles north of Boston. And in 1774, Marblehead was the second largest city in Massachusetts. It was also one of the greatest economic hubs of Massachusetts. Fortunes were made on cod fishing and as well as trade. And it was really one of the mainsprings of the Massachusetts economy. And these men were extremely wealthy. Many of them, but it was also, you know, you had thousands of men that would go out on boats and fish the Grand Banks, which were the most dangerous waters in the world at the time. You know, they were fighting against nature constantly. But what's interesting and unique about this group is it was also the first diverse regiment. And many of these men were African-Americans, Native Americans, there was Hispanics. They all crewed these boats together, and skin color didn't matter in the midst of a raging storm. When it was life and death decisions had to be made, and that would later translate into on the battlefield.
How did they go from cod fishermen and people who are accumulating some wealth because of the Grand Banks? How do you go from that to having a business end of an oar, right, in your hand? Normally, you would think these guys would be senior level officers or by regiments. How do you actually go to doing the hard work that it takes to basically be a deck seaman?
It was a interference by the crown. The crown was interfering in their lives constantly. They were impressing many of these men. Literally, they'd go out on their boats
for the navy.
For the navy, and impressment at this time was slavery. They'd pull up to a boat and they'd say, "Okay, congratulations, you're part of the Royal Navy now." And it was a life commitment.
That's Nelson's Navy.
And they'd pay.
It was such a good lifestyle. Some of the guys actually tell them what a press gang is and why it was so.
They would just go on shore and they would just round up people. Or they would go and seize, you know, they'd go up, pull up against a ship, and they would go on board, and they'd take them. But the Marbleheaders fought
because
back.
You were a subject.
Because you were a subject.
And by the way, when you were impressed in the Royal Navy, you would, in all likelihood, never return home.
You would never return home. You'd die on ship.
Yeah, or somewhere in the Caribbean, or the Royal Navy controlled the world at that time, was controlling the
it
world.
It didn't matter if you had a family, anything.
Tough break for a swell guy.
But these guys fought back. In the opening scene of The Indispensables is Michael Corbett's ship being boarded, and Michael Corbett threw a harpoon at the British lieutenant's jugular vein and severed it.
Michael Corbett, as an American, let the Royal Navy know how enthusiastic he was about being impressed.
And it was none other than John Adams that defended him in court and got him off.
How did you get off after killing a Royal Naval
That's how
lieutenant in with a harpoon?
John Adams at that time was the first super lawyer.
Did
in
I
the
say
States.
That? I say that these guys were great lawyers, John Adams. Hey, he didn't. He wasn't the guy, the driving force in independence for nothing, right?
He even had the crew of the British ship sympathetic after he deposed all of them.
So talk about that. So a press gang comes on a ship,
yeah,
and says because you're a subject, not a citizen. We think we got a better deal for you. You're going to get on this man of war and to parts unknown. And you leave home in the morning to go fishing. You're never to return because you're on a Royal Navy ship, never to go back home again. Corbett says, "I don't think I want to do that." He picks up a harpoon.
It's really dramatic, and it's all in the testimony of the trial. And Corbett actually said no. And there was a literally a line in the sand. There was some sand on the deck, and he put the sand out in, with his foot and said, if you cross it, I will throw a harpoon right at your jugular.
So he gave the guy a warning.
He gave the guy a warning. The British lieutenant came forward.
Well, of course, a British lieutenant in the Royal and Nelson's Navy is not going to say Corbett nice.
And
but
he got a harpoon right to the neck.
Did he die?
He died.
So, we got a how to, by the way, you got to get the book, The Indispensables. One thing I will tell you about Patrick K. O'Donnell's book, they're full of, this is not high level 60,000 feet. You're literally on the deck plates or you're on the pitching deck. You get to see what is exactly, because your research, you go back.
It's all primary documents.
First off, the ones he did for Korea, which is a national treasure, because a lot of these veterans have done, you went through and spent thousands of hours of interviews. First-person interviews with people to get what it was like. In Fallujah, you ain't embedded with the Marines. So when you go door-to-door, O'Donnell's there writing it down. Or he's interviewed somebody. If he can't interview him, because in the Revolution it's a little hard, right? You go back to the original diaries, journals, etc., and it's all factual.
It's all factual. I use the original pension files that these men had, the original oral histories, if you will, of what they said and did.
Because in a pension file, you couldn't lie. That's how you get.
You'd go in front of the court and say under oath what you did.
And it had to be vetted. There were a couple of three people showing up for pensions, right? And they had to vet. Just being Americans, right? You're always going to get guys. So we're going to finish with the opening story of The Indispensable. We're going to take a short commercial break. Other breaking news out of Georgia. We got a lot going on here this morning. We're honored to have Patrick K. O'Donnell. I want this posse to power into this book. This is about patriots. This is what happened hundreds of years ago to fight for our freedom. That fight continues today in Arizona. And guess what? It's going to spread to Georgia. All next in the War Room.
It's all started, everything's begun, and you are over. Because we're taking down the CCP. Spread the word all through Hong Kong.
But The Indispensables. The Wall Street Journal yesterday had a review by Mark Spencer, a noted historian, in the Wall Street Journal. This is a rave. I actually had to look and see if one of Patrick's relatives wrote this. No, it's an absolute rave. The book is already number one in history, number one on Amazon in history, number one in politics also.
Revolutionary War history.
Revolutionary War history.
It's 122 overall. Amazon.
Okay, I want everybody to power into this book, The Indispensables, right now. It has also gone through its first – you've already gone – it's in second printing already.
Yeah, 2 weeks ahead of before we even publication. It's also in the front of the store at Barnes & Noble and pretty much everywhere.
This is one – also, on these types of books, you've got to get these and get them for your grandkids and your kids. These are the types of books they ought to be reading because this goes back to the revolutionary generation. This goes back to what it's all about. Remember, I keep saying, and the generals say, it's always for the children and grandchildren. However, it's Burke's dictum. We owe as much to who came before us as we owe who comes after us. You're here. That's what human agency is. You're here for one period of time on Earth, right? And in that period of time, you get the free choice to use your agency. That's what this show is about, right? But we owe, going back generations, all the way to the revolutionary generation and even before that, but the revolutionary generation particularly, because you've had the greatest generation, you've had the revolutionary generation, and I think you've got the ones that fought and won the Civil War, and you have this generation today that's coming up, and they're fire breathers, and they're going to be, I think, our new greatest generation. In The Indispensables, finish with the opening story. I got a Navy, Royal Navy lieutenant with a harpoon in his neck. He dies. Right. And then what happens?
And then Corbett goes to trial. And the transcripts of the trial are what I used to build the scene of the opening scene of this book. And Corbett, it's really quite interesting. He's such an obscure figure, but he works with the main trading houses in Marblehead. He brings back the arms from Spain and the gunpowder. That's our first foreign aid ever, even before we're a country. It's through the Marbleheaders. They forge these contacts with Spain and these alliances, which become crucial, absolutely crucial, especially in terms of powder. But the town goes through really an interesting transformation in 73, 74, sort of a lot like today. They're hit with a virus that they bring in through ships, through the merchants, and they try to quarantine it. They have pest houses where they put, you know, people that have the virus, but they also come up with a novel solution for the time. They try an inoculation hospital. An inoculation at this time is not hard science. It either kills you or it cures you, and it's people are terrified of it. But they have a doctor who's
a little rougher in those days than today. It's not about wearing a mask.
You get pustules all over your face. It's really a brutal disease. But the town is divided politically from the virus. The Patriots build the hospital, and the Loyalists can't stand it. And they try.
Why the Loyalists can't stand it?
It's a power thing and control. They send a mob of half a dozen guys or more with torches and tar, and they burn it to the ground when the Patriots are in the hospital. What happens next is the Patriots, who are the owners of the hospital, have a writ where the sheriff comes out and arrests the guys that burned it down. But a mob, which the Loyalists incite of thousands of people, literally storm the jail with crowbars and axes and break the guys out. And then what happens next is really extraordinary. The proprietors of the hospital have their houses surrounded by a mob. The main character of the book is a guy by the name of John Glover. He's about a 5'3", scrappy French and Indian War veteran, and he's not having it. He has a cannon that he loaded cannon that he puts in the foyer of his house, and he says, "I'll fix them." And as soon as the crowd comes to his front lawn, he orders the doors put open. And the cannon is there, and he's got it with a torch in hand, and he said, "Disperse." And they do.
That was the original Get Off My Lawn.
It is the original Get Off My Lawn.
But hold it. Okay, stop. I got to stop here. This is the thing about immortals in here. People talk about today, we're disunited. You know, worst ever. You hear all this nonsense from these clowns on the mainstream media. That's why you got to read these books. Described as the country between loyalists and patriots. You had the one-third in the middle, but you had about... How intense, how nasty, and how brutal. Because people forget, the Revolution was also a civil war at the same time.
It was. It was a civil war. It was a political revolution before a kinetic revolution. There's a lot going on. And liberty and freedom are concepts that are really resonating in 73, 74. And it's from Marblehead. Many of the guys like Elbridge Gerry are putting out these concepts that are really unique and novel for the time, and it's starting to resonate with people. But you still have half the town, and many of the wealthiest members of the town are ardent loyalists, best friends of General Gage. Gage stays at their house, for instance.
The British general.
Yes.
Yep.
And but it's very intense. And one of the main characters of the book is a guy by the name of Nathaniel Bond, and Dr. Bond runs the inoculation hospital. But Bond...
The one they burned.
The one that they burned to the ground. But Bond, at Lexington and Concord, he's a patriot. But he has a Hippocratic oath. He treats everybody. He actually treats the British soldiers there. And that causes the patriots in the town to believe that he's a loyalist. His house is surrounded.
The patriot's not buying the Hippocratic. He's a patriot, he gets care. If he's a loyalist...
He writes this letter to Elbridge Gerry. In 1775, pleading for his life, and he has a court martial. He's exonerated. But Dr. Bond becomes the fighting surgeon of the Indispensables. He's a company commander through the entire war, a guy that's initially canceled, literally, fighting surgeon through the whole war. He stays on. Half the regiment actually goes home after Trenton. He stays on. And then Washington taps him for the greatest decision that he ever made. Which at the time, the army was having 20 to 25% casualties because of smallpox. They're dying left and right. He orders Bond to inoculate the army. Many believe it's Washington's greatest strategic decision because they're not able to continue the fight. And Bond dies as a result. And he's an obscure figure that has never been written about until The Indispensables.
That's the thing with Immortals and The Indispensables, is that when you read these books and see the stories of these people that history has forgotten about, you understand the giants on the shoulders that we stand.
Yes.
Right? These are giants. And at the time, they're just common men and women. It is the way that you're going to be referred to 100 years from now. right? We're in a fourth turning right now. This is exactly like the Revolution, the Civil War, Great Depression, World War II. This is a great fourth turning in American history. 100 years from now, they're going to write about this time and place, right? Whether it's Arizona or Georgia, things are going on, okay? And that's why these individuals had the opportunity to be counted on, right? And at that moment, what drove their decision-making of why you would give all and give up your practice, give up your wealth, give up the cod fishing, and become part of the Indispensables?
It was personal. It was their personal duty and honor, but it was also the British totally shut down Boston. They also had something called the Fisheries Act. Their livelihood was completely destroyed economically by the British. So they were motivated.
Economic warfare.
Total economic warfare, which is another thing that's really important in this book. But they fight anyways, and they do it, you know, with no pay. They're, you know, hardly shoeless, bloody tracks at Trenton. I mean, this the hardship and sacrifice is extraordinary. Then they come home racked with PTSD. Most of these guys are bankrupt after the Revolutionary War, and many are dead. There's over 600 widows in Marblehead alone.
600 widows.
Yeah.
And bankrupt.
And thousands of orphans.
And they've given up everything for the revolutionary cause.
In some cases, for a country that had yet to be born.
Incredible. We're going to come back to that. I want to go now to somebody who knows about the founding generation, Michael Patrick Leahy. Michael Patrick Leahy wrote the greatest book about the Tea Party and tied it back to the original foundational documents. By the way, we didn't produce the show. Like, we didn't start it. Starting at Independence Hall was just serendipity. Having Patrick K. O'Donnell, we had planned this for a while because of the day of publication, but then having Leahy available. Michael, so I know you're one of the great, not just leaders of the Tea Party movement, but really someone that understands the founding documents, the revolutionary generation. Your Georgia Star, the story you broke today about the still, we don't have certification documents from the ballots. Talk to us about what's going on there, and where do you think this heads in Georgia? Okay, I know we're going to get Michael Patrick Leahy momentarily. Okay, let's get it worked out and then come back. I want to go back to Patrick. As soon as we get him up, we're trying to do a lot here. We're throwing a lot onto the production crew.
It's too many Patricks is what's happening.
That's exactly right.
Michael Patrick. How long did it take you to research this book, and how long did it take you to research Washington's Immortals?
It took 5 years for both books.
5 years each.
This one was a much harder research haul, though.
Why?
More obscure unit. I had to literally rebuild the regiment from the muster rolls that are. I have a picture of the muster rolls in this book, and I took all the pension file applications. To reconstruct the regiment from the ground up, basically, and I found just these extraordinary stories that had been lost in history. But it was a lot harder to do. It's a more complex book than Washington's Immortals, even though it spans a shorter period of time.
Okay, I want by the way, Wall Street Journal gave it a rave yesterday, an absolute rave review from Mark G. Spencer. Go check it out if you want to before you buy it. Read the rave review in the Wall Street Journal. Here's the thing about why buy this book and give it to friends, etc. When you finish O'Donnell's books, whether it's the book of Fallujah, whether it's the book about the Chosin Reservoir, your books, with the grittiness of the combat and the sacrifice, there's a feeling you have, and one of the feelings is you're proud to be associated. You're proud to be from a country of the common man, because your stories are all about the little guys, whether it's non-commissioned officers in a Marine rifle platoon in Fallujah, or it's in Chosin Reservoir on Give Me Tomorrow, or whether it's the Washington's Immortals. These are people that have been, their deeds are still there, but even some of those are forgotten, but they certainly have been forgotten in the history of time, in the midst of time. You not just bring them to life. You finish these books and you go, wow, now I understand why we have things like the Memorial Day and why we have things like the 4th of July, right? Which have also been lost. They've kind of, let's go to the beach and let's have some hot dogs, etc. You have a good feeling and understanding exactly the DNA of the country, right? The DNA of the country and what the sacrifice was. Raheem.
So I understand that it's not exactly tradition to give gifts for the 4th of July.
Wow.
But I think this may be one of those things that you want to start doing because not just under this current administration have we seen the, you know, the revocation of the you know, the Garden of Heroes that was supposed to be built.
Oh, genius.
But also, we saw how the media, the corporate media and the left, mocked President Trump for wanting to do a big 4th of July celebrations, right?
Mocked it.
So let's double down.
I love that. Give it to the young people in your life. Be back, Michael Patrick Leahy and Patrick K. O'Donnell in a moment in the War Room.